Well, welcome to the Catholic Reason, a radio show produced by St. Michael Catholic Radio, where we think through various claims made by the Catholic Church concerning issues of faith, morality, and culture, and provide reasons behind those claims. My name is Carlo Broussard, and I'm a staff apologist and speaker for Catholic Answers and a member of the Chancery Evangelization Team at the Diocese of Tulsa in eastern Oklahoma. If you're just tuning in this week, we've been talking about the philosophical worldview of scientism. And last week, in our last week's episode, we distinguished between two versions of scientism, a strong version and a weak version. And I explained what those two versions are, and we focused last week on strong version by itself, which states scientific knowledge is the only real kind of knowledge. And we dealt with that, and we gave four strategies as to how we can refute strong scientism. Now, in today's episode, we're going to focus on the weak version of scientism. I'll go back over what the weak version of scientism is, and we'll think through some reasons as to why it's false. And so our Catholic claim for this episode is going to be that the weak version of scientism is false, and we're going to give some reasons for that claim. But before we do that, what I'd like to do is to sort of refresh your memory, call to mind, or for anyone who's listening and tuning in for the first time, to share with you in summary the four strategies that we can employ to refute strong scientism, the reasons why we would say strong scientism is false. Again, strong scientism being the view that scientific knowledge is the only real kind of knowledge. And so the first strategy that we gave for refuting strong scientism was to show that scientism is self-referentially incoherent. And what that means is that if you take the belief of scientism itself and you identify the principle of scientism, and you apply the principle to scientism itself, you see that scientism is refuted, is falsified. Therefore, it's self-referentially incoherent. To state it in sort of analogous terms, it pulls the rug out from underneath its feet. The minute it tries to plant its feet on the rug, it pulls the rug out from underneath its feet, or as some have said, it cannot pass its own test. And we gave a syllogism in our refutation of strong scientism in last week's episode. And so rather than going through all the details, I'd like to just share that syllogism with you again, which I think provides a nice summary and captures the logical argumentation as to why scientism is self-referentially incoherent and therefore worthy of rejection by reason. And so consider premise one. Any knowledge that's outside the boundaries of scientific knowledge is not real knowledge. That's basically what strong scientism is or says. Premise two, scientism itself, that is premise one, is knowledge that's outside the boundaries of scientific knowledge. There is no method of modern science that we can utilize in order to arrive at the truth value of premise one, namely scientism itself. And so thereby, scientism itself is not the product of the methods of modern science, and therefore is not scientific knowledge. The belief of scientism itself, scientism is a form of knowledge that goes beyond the boundaries of scientific knowledge. All right, so therefore the conclusion is scientism is not real knowledge. Again, premise one, any knowledge that's outside the boundaries of scientific knowledge is not real knowledge. That's the claim of science, strong scientism. Premise two, scientism is knowledge that's outside the boundaries of scientific knowledge. And so therefore, scientism itself is not real knowledge. You see how it's self-referentially incoherent? It's self-refuting. And of course, if it's not real knowledge, then we should reject it, right? So that was the first strategy that we gave to refute strong scientism. The second strategy for refuting strong scientism is to show that scientism undermines science itself as a rational form of inquiry. And this is something we looked at in last week's episode. And just by way of summary, science presupposes certain things that cannot be the product of modern science, presupposes certain knowledge that cannot be the product of modern science. So, for example, that there is an external world outside the minds of scientists, science presupposes that. That the world consists of cause and effect patterns, science presupposes that. And that the human intellect is capable of uncovering these cause-effect patterns within the world. Science presupposes that knowledge. So if science itself presupposes these certain things, this certain knowledge, well then surely that presupposed knowledge cannot be the product of the methods of modern science. And if it cannot be the product of the methods of modern science, well, then it's not scientific knowledge. But remember, scientism says any knowledge outside the boundaries of scientific knowledge ain't real knowledge. And so the very knowledge that must be assumed in order to even do science, it is not real knowledge according to scientism, according to strong scientism. And so if the very fundamental foundation stones, right, the presuppositions and the assumptions that you need in order to get science off the ground in the first place is not real knowledge, well, then science can't get off the ground in the first place, right? So strong scientism actually undermines science itself as a rational form of inquiry because it demands, it entails that the presuppositions or the assumptions of modern science ain't real knowledge, okay? And then the third strategy we gave in refutation of strong scientism was to show that scientism undermines the reality of the human mind itself. I mean, just think about it. The mind, the intellect, it's not subject to empirical verification and it's non-quantifiable. And given that it's not subject to empirical verification and it's not quantifiable, then that means it's beyond the boundaries of what the methods of modern science can detect. And if it's beyond the boundaries of the methods of what modern science, beyond the boundaries of what the methods of modern science can detect, well, then it's not going to be real knowledge. Knowledge that we have in intellect, that's not going to be real knowledge according to strong scientism, because that's a knowledge that cannot be the product of the methods of modern science. So it ain't scientific knowledge. And if it ain't scientific knowledge, it ain't real knowledge according to strong scientism. And so strong scientism actually undermines the reality of the human mind itself, which is absurd because you need the human mind in order to conclude that strong scientism is true. And so again, strong scientism is self-refuting. This is yet another way in which it's self-refuting. And finally, the fourth strategy that we gave in last week's episode for refuting strong scientism was that scientism confuses, strong scientism that is, in order to be precise here, confuses methodology with ontology. Methodology, the method which we use to discover reality, strong scientism confuses that, the method, with ontology. That is, the reality itself. Because think about it, many conclude that physical reality is the only reality because science can only detect physical reality. So people will think, well, if science can't detect it, well, then it ain't real, right? Whatever knowledge that you have that is not the product of the methods of modern science, it's not real knowledge. And so this is similar, as we stated in last week's episode, taking an example from philosopher Edward Fraser. This would be like saying there are no plastic cups on the beach because the metal detector hasn't detected the plastic cups. That would be a confusion of methodology with ontology, right? Just because the metal detector can't detect plastic cups says nothing whether or not plastic cups exist. It's simply a manifestation of the limitations of the detecting powers of the metal detector. Similarly, just because science can't detect certain things that go beyond the boundaries of what science can detect doesn't mean that those things don't exist. Just because there is certain knowledge that goes beyond the boundaries of modern scientific knowledge doesn't mean that knowledge ain't real. It's simply a manifestation of the limitations of the methods of modern science and what kind of knowledge it can give us. And so ultimately, strong scientism confuses methodology with ontology. Okay, so that's enough for our summary and our refresher of what strong scientism is and for strategies as to how we can refute it. And for all of the other details, in order to bolster that up, you can listen to last week's episode, which you can actually download the podcast by searching of The Catholic Reason in any podcast search engine that you use, or just go to the Eastern Oklahoma Catholic Podcast, and then the podcast is hosted there. And you can also download and listen to the podcast version of The Catholic Reason on my website, carlobrusart.com, under the audio tab, The Catholic Reason. Okay, now, I said that there was a weak version of scientism, in contrast to the strong version, still falling under the general umbrella of scientism, because the weak version of scientism is another way in which some will say science has eliminated the need for God in explaining the universe. Now, the weak version of scientism is the view that science is sufficient to give an exhaustive explanation of the universe, thus making the God hypothesis not necessary, even if he does exist. And this view, as I stated last week, was articulated succinctly by the late Stephen Hawking, God rest his soul, in a 2010 Larry King Live interview in which my former boss, Father Robert Spitzer, participated in, where Dr. Hawking said, "God may exist, but science can explain the universe without the need for a creator." So for Hawking, there's no need to appeal to God to explain the universe because science can get the job done. The assumption being modern science has the capacity to give an exhaustive explanation of the universe. And I began to articulate and explain what the weak version of scientism is. Again, a refresher from last week's episode because we explained it then, but I wanted to refresh your memory as to what the weak version of scientism is. And I was appealing to the late Dr. Stephen Hawking, where he espoused this weak version of scientism, saying that God may exist, but science can explain the universe without the need for a creator. So, in other words, there's no need to appeal to God to explain the universe because science can get the job done. Now, this belief assumes that modern science actually has the capacity to give an exhaustive explanation of the material world without an appeal to God. And as such, for many, every new advance of natural science is seen as one more nail in the divine coffin, right? Science, it's seen as evidence, more evidence that science is eliminating God in the need of explaining the universe. So that raises an important question. Can science sufficiently explain the universe such that there's no need to appeal to God? Can science even do this, right? The Catholic claim is no. Science is not sufficient to explain the universe such that there's no need to appeal to God. And we're going to defend that claim in today's episode. And I'm going to give, I think I have four reasons that I have planned to give as to why science is not sufficient to explain the universe such that there's no need for God, and thereby refuting this weak version of scientism. So the first reason is that science is an inductive method, right? Science's explanatory power is not sufficient because it relies on the inductive method in order to validate its hypotheses. Contrary to the deductive method, the inductive method moves from knowledge of particulars, right? Particular things, to general conclusions. Now, without getting into the details that differentiate the inductive and deductive methods, suffice to say that absolute certainty about one's conclusion is impossible when employing the inductive method. Since science relies on the inductive method, it follows that scientists can never be absolutely certain that their theories explaining the universe are absolutely complete. They can never be absolutely certain that they've discovered and observed every piece of data necessary to give a complete explanation of the universe, much less a complete enough explanation that would negate the need for God. My mentor, former mentor and friend, and boss, Father Robert Spitzer. I used to work for Father Robert Spitzer in the Maja Center of Reason and Faith, and worked with him in sitting at his feet, learning some of this material concerning the relationship between God and science and stuff like that. I remember he liked to say, science cannot know what it has not yet discovered because it has not yet discovered it, right? Let that one sink in, right? I'll repeat that. Science can't know what it hasn't yet discovered because it hasn't yet discovered it. In other words, scientists can only be certain about what they've already discovered through empirical observation. Certainty can never be had for whether there is some piece of data enshrouded in the past or a piece of data beyond our event horizon. Therefore, there necessarily exists in science a perpetual openness. It's just the nature of the beast. A perpetual openness to discovering something new that could alter its current theory about the universe. That just belongs to the nature of science, that perpetual openness to new discovery to change the current theory. Philosopher and my friend, Dennis Bonnet, a great Thomist philosopher, sums it up nicely in his online article, Does Modern Physics Refute Thomistic Philosophy? He writes this, and I thought this would be worth sharing with you. Scientific research, and I'm quoting here from his article, scientific research relies upon an inductive method from many particular observations to universal conclusions that can never achieve logical necessity, right? Logical necessity would refer to for example, the principle of non-contradiction. Something cannot both exist and not exist at the same time in the same respect. That involves logical necessity. Or you might reason from a deductive form of whatever doesn't have existence of virtue of itself must receive its existence from something outside of itself. That would be the Thomistic principle of the sufficient reason, okay? The tree outside doesn't have existence in virtue of its own essence or of itself. And so therefore the conclusion being that the tree outside must receive its existence from something outside of itself. That conclusion follows by way of logical necessity from the truth of the premises. Granted, we don't have time to defend those premises, but that's just an example of what Dr. Bonnet here refers to as logical necessity, in contrast to a conclusion that would have logical necessity, in contrast to an inductive method that could lead us to a conclusion that would only give us certain probable knowledge and not logical necessity. So, continuing with Bonnet's quote here, experimental verification of hypotheses entails the logical fallacy of affirming the consequent, remedied hopefully by a perfect critical experiment, he says. Negative experimental results can falsify a hypothesis, but no amount of positive results can ever absolutely prove one is true, since some unanticipated extraneous factor always might have produced the positive result. Competent scientists always admit that the experimental results merely tend to support their hypotheses. Both these logical weaknesses entail that the laws of physics possess neither absolute certitude nor guaranteed universality. Now, if this is true, if what Dr. Bonnet is saying is true, that science in principle must be open to new discoveries and new discoveries that could alter the current theories and explanations of certain data within the reality, well, then one can never rationally claim, notice I emphasize rationally claim, that science can give a complete and exhaustive explanation of the universe, much less a complete enough explanation that God is no longer needed as its creator. So the claim that God doesn't matter because science can sufficiently explain the universe is unfounded. So why can't science sufficiently explain the universe in such a way that there's no need for God? Because science relies on the inductive method, and science can never know that it has exhausted its observation of all the relevant data necessary for explaining the physical universe. Because of that perpetual openness, one can never rationally claim science can get the job done, to give a complete and exhaustive explanation. Now note, can science give us adequate knowledge about the physical world? Yes, it can give us real knowledge about the physical world. But what we're saying here, our Catholic claim, is that science cannot give us a complete and exhaustive explanation of the physical world, such that there's no need for God. That's what we're claiming. And we want to be very clear on that, because in no way are we trying to diss science here and reject science. We recognize science as a legitimate tool in the tool shed to know things about reality. I mean, the methods of modern science are a good thing. And this is a manifestation of the divine wisdom, that there is this way of discovering things about reality, empirical observation and scientific hypotheses, going and observe things to test those hypotheses. But what we're simply saying is that it's not the only way, and that nor can it possibly give us a complete explanation. And so there's going to be other tools in the tool shed that we're going to need to pull out and employ in order to know the further things that are to be known about reality that go beyond the boundaries of modern science. And that's all we're saying here. Okay, so that's the first reason. Science is an inductive method, and so the weak version of scientism fails there. Now, the second reason, we're not going to be able to complete this second reason as to why the weak version of scientism is false before our break. We're going to have to stop here at some point within the next minute or so just hang tight. The second reason why the weak version of scientism is false is because the laws of nature can't be the ultimate explanation of the universe. And the reason why we focus on the laws of nature here is because, you know, science fundamentally relies on the laws of nature, right? And so what we're going to say here in the second reason, that the laws of nature by which science explains natural phenomena cannot, in principle cannot be the ultimate explanation of the universe. Because if science is going to give an ultimate explanation of the universe, well, then that means somehow the laws of nature that science relies upon to explain the world is going to be the ultimate explanation of the universe. But what we're going to argue here is that the laws of nature cannot be the ultimate explanation of the universe. And so the question is, why is that? Well, for starters, laws of nature are shorthand descriptions of the way things tend to behave, given the kinds of things that they are. That's to say, given their nature or essence, they tend to behave in certain ways. And laws of nature are just shorthand descriptions of how those things act and behave, given the kinds of things that they are. And so, for example, the law of nature tells us water freezes at 32 degrees Fahrenheit. That's simply a description of the nature of water having a tendency or a disposition to freeze at that temperature. We were just beginning to give our second reason as to why the weak version of scientism is false, namely that the laws of nature that science relies upon in order to explain natural phenomena cannot be the ultimate explanation of the universe. And we started explaining how laws of nature or simply shorthand descriptions of the way things tend to behave, given the kinds of things that they are. That's to say, they tend to behave given in a certain way, given their nature or their essence. And so we gave the example of the law of nature that tells us water freezes at 32 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, that law of nature is simply a description of the nature of water having a tendency or a disposition to freeze at that temperature. Another example, the law of nature that tells us fire burns is a description of the inherent powers of the material substances that release heat in the chemical reaction of combustion. The laws of nature, therefore, are nothing but descriptions, as we said, shorthand descriptions of nature's essences with inhering power, properties, and powers that manifest themselves when certain conditions are met. That's fundamentally what the laws of nature are. And remember, the laws of nature that science depends upon in order to explain natural phenomena. Now, because laws of nature simply describe the behavior patterns of physical things given their nature, the laws of nature necessarily presuppose the existence and operation of the physical things that they describe. Again, laws of nature necessarily presuppose the existence and operation of the physical things that they describe. They presuppose the law of nature that tells us water freezes at 32 degrees of Fahrenheit, presupposes the existence and operation of water, like the dispositional properties and inherent potencies or potentials of water. Okay? So now, if the laws of nature presuppose the existence and operations of the things that they describe, well, then the laws of nature cannot possibly explain why such things exist in the first place and why these things operate the way they do rather than some other way. So, for example, why fire burns instead of makes cold, okay? The law of nature simply describes that fire burns, but it doesn't explain why a fire is existing in the first place, right? Nor does it explain why a fire is burning rather than emitting coldness. That's a question that science has to remain silent in the face of. Perhaps an example will help flesh this out, okay? And I take this example again from philosopher Edward Fraser. He does a great job in talking about these issues, so I'm just ripping off of him. And so thank you, Dr. Fraser. Consider the game of checkers, right? He might not use checkers precisely, but he uses perhaps some other game. I can't remember if he uses checkers or not. So, but the idea itself is coming from Dr. Fraser. So consider the game of checkers. The rules tell you which direction the pieces can move, right? The rules tell you how the game is won and so forth. But knowing the rules doesn't tell you why the game exists in the first place. Why the checkers are black and red instead of purple and blue. Why the game is governed by one set of rules rather than another. The makers of the game could have adopted the rules, say, my kids use when they, you know, play checkers. The rules that my kids use determine where the checker pieces can move horizontally and vertically instead of just diagonally, right? So my kids might adopt another set of rules, but the game of checkers adopts a specific set of rules that, you know, you move certain ways. Okay. And so the point is that in order to arrive at knowledge of the why, like why the checker pieces can only move in a certain direction diagonally instead of horizontally, you're going to have to stand outside the game and outside the rules. The mere rules themselves explaining how the game operates, how you win, how the checker pieces are supposed to move, those rules by themselves cannot explain why the rules are the way they are rather than some other way. Why the checker pieces move this way rather than some other way. Why the game even exists in the first place. The rules itself cannot answer those questions. You're going to have to get outside the game. You're going to have to get outside the rules in order to answer those questions. Similarly, science seeks to explain things in the universe with the quote-unquote rules, the laws of nature that govern the game. That is, the game of the natural world and the things in it. But that presupposes that the natural world and the things in it actually exist in the first place. Just like the rules of the game of checkers presuppose that the board and the pieces in the game itself exist. Hopefully you can see that analogy there, right? So again, the rules of the game of checkers presupposes that the game exists and all of the things involved in the game. Similarly, science and the rules that it relies upon, the laws of nature, presupposes the natural world itself and the things that exist in the natural world, which the laws of nature describe. Okay? So to the question, what determines that there is to be a universe within time, space, and or to be a universe with time, space, and matter, instead of no universe at all? Well, science is silent on that. just like the rules of the checker games, to the question, why is there a checker game in the first place? The rules are silence. So to the laws of nature and science that utilizes the laws of nature to explain the universe cannot answer the question, why is there a universe in the first place with time, space, and matter, rather than no universe at all? Or to the question, what determines the universe to consist of material things that have quarks as their most fundamental level of reality, instead of material things that are only reduced to molecules? Science is silent. Why? Because science and the laws of nature that it uses to explain the universe presupposes these truths, presupposes that these things exist in the universe. These are questions that can be answered only by stepping outside the game and the rules of science into the realm of philosophy. So the theist says God is the only answer to these questions. God is the only answer as to why the universe and the things that make up the universe have existence in the first place rather than not. It is God who answers the question as to why there is a particular order of cause and effect in this way rather than some other way. And of course, that would ultimately rely upon the natures of the things, but why are there these types of things rather than some other types of things with different natures? Or why are there these things in the first place rather than not? Only God's going to be able to answer. Only the philosopher appealing to God is going to be able to answer that question. Now, the atheist is going to disagree with the theist and seek to prove the theist wrong, and that's fine. But if he chooses to do so, the atheist that is, he's going to have to do it with philosophy, not science. Science is going to come up to that boundary, right, beyond which it cannot go concerning these questions. These questions are the boundary, and science can only go so far and can't go beyond that to answer these questions. So science is going to have to be a tool that you leave in the tool shed, and you have to take out another tool, namely philosophy, to answer these sorts of questions. Why is there the game and the rules, i.e. the universe and the laws of nature in the first place, rather than not? Philosophy is going to have to be able to answer that question. So since science leaves open these ultimate why questions, it cannot possibly give an exhaustive explanation of the universe, and thus cannot, in principle, cannot explain away the need for God, because the theist says God is the answer to these questions. So again, since science cannot answer these ultimate why questions, why the universe in the first place rather than not, why the things in the universe, why these things rather than some other things, it follows logically that science can't give the type of complete and exhaustive explanation that it would need to be able to give to exclude the need for God. So science cannot get the job done when it comes to giving a complete and exhaustive explanation of the universe, and therefore, the weak version of scientism ultimately is false. It's not true. So as smart as the late Dr. Stephen Hawking was, his philosophical viewpoint here, that science is a tool that can give you a complete explanation of the universe, is simply unfounded, right? So the late Dr. Stephen Hawking was dabbling in waters or in issues, namely the issues of philosophy, that he was not competent to dabble in. As brilliant of a physicist as he was actually crossing those boundaries of modern science into the realm of philosophy, and as you can see, was not thinking correctly there. And we've given two reasons so far as to why the weak version of scientism is false. We said, number one, science relies on the inductive method, and so therefore can never arrive at knowledge that would be absolutely certain. There's always a perpetual openness to discovering new data that could alter its current theories and explaining the physical world, and so therefore, in principle, can never give an exhaustive and complete explanation of the universe. Secondly, the laws of nature that science relies upon in order to explain the natural world cannot be the ultimate explanation of the universe, because the laws of nature presuppose the things in their natures and that they exist in the first place rather than not. And so therefore, science cannot possibly answer those questions as to why those things exist rather than not, and therefore cannot give an exhaustive, complete explanation of the universe. Now, reason three as to why the weak version of scientism is false is that science fails to tell us how to interpret what science tells us about the world. Here's how philosopher Edward Fraser puts the argument in his book, Introduction to Scholastic Metaphysics. He writes, there's also the question of how to interpret what science tells us about the world. For example, is the world fundamentally comprised of substances or events? What is it to be a cause? Which science presupposes, right, that there are causes. What is the nature of the universals referred to in scientific laws, concepts like quark, electron, atom, and so on? What are their natures is what he's asking here. Do they exist over and above the particular things that instantiate them? Do scientific theories really give us description of objective reality in the first place, or are they just useful tools for predicting the course of experience? Scientific findings can shed light on such metaphysical questions, but can never fully answer them. Yet, he goes on, if science depends upon philosophy both to justify its presuppositions and to interpret its results, the falsity of scientism is doubly assured. As John Keats concludes, hence philosophy and not science is a stronger candidate for being the very paradigm of rationality. Now, think about it, friends. If science cannot properly interpret, or let me just say this, that was wrong. Let me rephrase that. If science cannot completely, exhaustively, right, interpret what it tells us about the world, well, then it can't possibly give us an exhaustive and complete explanation of the universe. It's limited in its interpretation. And so therefore cannot give us that complete and exhaustive explanation of the universe that the weak version of scientism says science can in order to negate the need for God. So that's reason number three. Science fails to tell us how to interpret what science tells us about the real world. And finally, we come to reason number four. Science presupposes fundamental features of physical reality that are starting points for arguments for God's existence, right? And so there are certain features of the material world that must be real in order for the methods of modern science even to work. And our claim is that it's these features that modern science presupposes that are the very starting points for theistic arguments. So since science presupposes these features, and it's these features that we would argue demand God's existence, the conclusion is that science can't possibly eliminate the need for God, right? Science can't get behind what it's presupposing and eliminate God because those things that it's presupposing are the very starting points or evidence for God. And so the question arises, well, what are these fundamental features about the material world that science presupposes that theists would say are the starting points for arguing for God's existence? Well, number one, is change itself. We can start with change. If we were to conduct an experiment to find out the degree of heat needed to turn, say, solid candle wax into liquid, we would necessarily have to assume that change is real. Without the assumption that change is real, there would be no reason to perform an experiment to see what degree of heat is needed to change what's in its solid state to a state of liquid. So hopefully you can see that any sort of scientific experiment, any sort of use of the methods of modern science, anytime we do science, is going to necessarily presuppose change, okay? Now, not only does science presuppose the reality of change, it also presupposes fundamental features of material beings necessary for change to even be possible. So you just have this presupposition of change in general. But in order for change to happen, certain features about material things got to be in place. One is which is called being in potency. The ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle called it that, being in potency. Now, I know what you're thinking. That's some highfalutin philosophical language. Talk to me in plain English, Carlo. I can't even talk to you in plain English. All right, so here it goes. I'll give it a shot. Take the piece of solid candle wax, for example. It's neither a dog nor liquid, right? That's easy enough. But isn't it true that the deprivation, the is-notness in each case is different? The solid wax's lack of being liquid is not quite the same as the solid wax's lack of being a puddle of liquid. And given the kind of thing wax is, it cannot become a dog. But when in a solid state, it does have potential to become a puddle of liquid. This potential to become liquid is what Aristotle meant by being in potency. Philosophers also call this built-in potency or immanent teleology. Immanent because the potential is in the wax, and teleology because the Greek word telos means end or goal. So being in potency is a feature of material things that change presupposes. Another is substantial form. Notice that our piece of solid wax has the potential to become liquid because of the kind of thing it is. It's not ice. It's not Odie the dog. It's not Garfield the cat. It's wax. Now, for the philosopher, that which makes the matter be wax and not something else is substantial form. The matter has the substantial form of wax, and it's that form that distinguishes the matter from having the form of ice, dog, or cat. So substantial form, the kind of thing something is, determines the potentials, the built-in directedness that the thing will have. They go hand in hand. And science, again, must assume this is true in order to do its job. Now, the explanation of the piece of wax changing into liquid is not complete until one includes a changer, what philosophers call an efficient cause. The experimenter recognizes that the solid wax has the inherent potential to become liquid, and so he's going to perform the experiment in the first place. But in order to actualize that potential, to make it happen, he must use something that can generate heat, such as fire, since the wax can't melt itself. And since fire is the cause of the change, it's called an efficient cause. And notice that the experimenter can't just use anything to melt the wax. He's got to use something that's the kind of thing that can generate heat, like fire. He can't use a piece of ice. And this, again, reveals the tie, the connection between substantial form, what makes the thing the kind of thing it is, and immanent teleology, or that inherent directedness to an end or goal. Now, matter's being in potency for a particular state of actuality, we call that teleology or final causality. Substantial forms, we call that formal causality. And efficient causes, we call that efficient causality, are all inextricably linked in explaining the structure of material beings and the change that they undergo. And such a framework is what makes science possible. If the scientists didn't think the change was possible in our wax experiment, and that the wax had the inherent potential to be melted into liquid, and that the heat that the fire produces, is needed to actualize the wax's potential to become liquid, well, then the scientists would have no reason. If he didn't think that all of that was possible and all of that was in place, well, then he'd have no reason to think that the same results would occur in repeated experiments, and thus would have no grounds for formulating a scientific law about the relationship between wax and heat. The scientist, therefore, must assume the reality of this tightly woven fabric of substantial forms, matters being in potency for a particular state of actuality, and efficient causality. Science has no choice but to accept this explanatory framework for material reality. And if the reality of these features of material reality is necessary for natural science to even be possible, right? They are incarnate in its very methods. Well, it follows that natural science cannot in principle explain them. So science presupposes all of these features of material reality. And so therefore, science cannot possibly explain these features of material reality. Well, guess what, folks? It's these features of material reality that classical theists have always appealed to as the starting points for reasoning to God's existence, as evidence that God exists. Change is the starting point for the first way of St. Thomas Aquinas. If there is change, there must be an unchanged changer, the unmoved mover, God. Efficient causality, second way of St. Thomas Aquinas. The fact of corruptibility, where you have material things of form and matter coming into existence, going out of existence, the third way of St. Thomas Aquinas. Different grades of perfection, different kinds of forms, substantial forms, fourth way of St. Thomas Aquinas. The idea that certain material things have an inherent directedness to certain effects, fire producing heat, fifth way of St. Thomas Aquinas. So think about it. If science presupposes all of these features that demonstrate God's existence or point to God's existence, science cannot possibly eliminate God's existence. Well, unfortunately, my friends, we're out of time for this week's episode. Again, the Catholic claim is that science can't sufficiently explain the universe without God, and we have reasons to think why this is so. Thank you so much for listening to The Catholic Reason with yours truly, Carlo Broussard. Again, you can download the podcast version at carlobroussard.com. Until next week, tell a friend. I'll talk to you then. God bless.